Sometimes a message is preached that you wish everyone on the planet could hear. When Jesus Put Shame to Shame by Elise Harbolt is one of those messages. The Holy Spirit anointed Elise to give these beautiful insights to God's healing love with such clarity. Allow this message to feed your soul with a deep sense of what Jesus has done for you.
Jesus, thank you for being the God of laughter and the God of connection and community, and we're just grateful to be here together. And I believe that we a lot of times feel things and experience things that we're not even aware of and that we don't even know how to say. And one of those things is shame. So I want to ask that this morning that you would speak through this message, however imperfect it is, to communicate your love to us in those places that feel broken and shameful. And I ask this in your name, amen. Okay, so this Valentine's Day, I was in Boston visiting a friend, not a guy. And I was staying in her apartment here on Broadway in Cambridge. And I actually was sick that day, so I tried to go to bed early. It didn't look like this outside. It was snowing, it was dark, it was just terrible. I don't like snow. And as I was trying to go to sleep, I heard a knock on the door, loud knock. And I was waiting for my friend to come back, so I thought, oh, maybe it's Darlie. So I went to the door, I said, is it Darlie? And the voice said, no, it's the Cambridge police. So I opened the door, and I was looking at a police officer who seemed just as unhappy to see me as I was to see him. And he said, do you own a white Honda Civic from New Jersey? And I said, well, it's my rental car. He was like, you're parked right in front of someone's driveway. And you need to come move your car or I'm going to tow you. So I ran, got my coat, got my shoes, and I'm coming outside. And as I was coming, I felt this like knot in my chest. It was just like hot and warm and gross. And I felt all these feelings in my body, like embarrassment. And I was started telling myself things like, you're a parking idiot. Like, how did you not see somebody's driveway? And how am I going to get myself out of this one? So as I was walking out, I saw the police car there, and the officer was talking to a woman who seemed quite upset, and he was saying, I'm sorry, ma'am, I know. The city's just not like it used to be. And so I was coming up getting ready to apologize when she saw me, and she said, did you not see my driveway when you parked your car? Or did you just not care? And I didn't know what to say. Like, what do you say? I didn't see it. I don't know how to park in the city. Duh. Like, I have an abstract thought life, and I'm not always aware of my physical surroundings. So I just decided to apologize. I said, I'm really sorry I didn't see it. And then she just kept going, and she was kind of yelling at me a little bit. And the inner dialogue that I was already telling myself about what an idiot I was, she was kind of agreeing with it. And so I finally said, is there anything I can do to make it right? And she said, yeah, move your car. So I guess that was a stupid question. Well, I moved my car and I was driving around trying to find a place to park that was legitimate, but it was late. Everyone had already come home. I couldn't find a place. My phone rang, and it was my friend Darlie. She had gotten back. She realized I wasn't there, and she was trying to help. So I started telling her what was happening, and I was trying to be tough, and I was just being matter-of-fact about it, and she said, oh, come back. I'll help you. So I drove back to her apartment, and she was, like, dragging a dumpster out of the way to create the special parking place for me, and she'd brought a note down that said special guest of and her phone number and a smiley face, and she put it on my dashboard, and she said, come on, come upstairs, and she said, are you okay? And I'm like, I started crying. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm crying now. But she was just so nice, I couldn't help it. And she made me some tea, and I was just sharing with her, like, I know I did something wrong, and I don't have a good excuse for it, but I think it's sad that we don't know how to do conflict without shaming each other. But I noticed as we started talking and Darlie made me laugh and I felt so accepted there and I was just drinking this tea, like that I didn't feel the shame anymore because it was crowded out by love. So this is Darlie, and she showed me Jesus in that story. Shame is something that we experience a lot without even really being aware, and part of that is because shame sells. So prior to the Industrial Revolution, like, people kind of just had what they needed and lived on farms, and if they needed something, they knew that they needed it, so they went to the store to buy it. So they didn't have the same, like, advertising campaigns and marketing stuff going on that we have now. Well, through and after the Industrial Revolution, all of a sudden there's tons of stuff, and the people that are manufacturing the stuff need a way to sell it, right? So you have to raise awareness about different needs. So I thought it was really interesting. I discovered that in the late 1800s, bad breath and body odor were not socially unacceptable. Like, they were just part of what it means to be a human, right? And if everyone has the same problem, then kind of no one has the problem, right? So there were companies that were coming up with these new products like toothpaste and mouthwash and soap and deodorant, and they needed to create some anxiety so that people would start buying their stuff. So this is one of the first ads that kind of connected social status with a product. And it's just a simple ad for Sozodont toothpaste. It said, "Beauty and fragrance are communicated to the mouth by Sozodont." But as time went on and the market got more competitive, some of the ads weren't really so innocent. This is poor Janet. Another admirer lost for Janet, all because of B.O. Selling Life Buoy health soap. And you see the little caption there. He thought, I'll never come so close to you again on a hot day. Yet, he said, I can enjoy your music better across the room. Here's another one. Gray hair cost her her job. And it's interesting, it wasn't until the 1960s that dandruff really became a big thing. And we're going to watch a short video to watch how that actually happened.
Who's that?
Phil Adams, Lou Jr.
Oh, he's gorgeous.
Except he's got one big problem, dandruff.
Uh-oh.
Shh. So stupid. I'd lick my dandruff problem.
Dandruff? You?
Like mad. Till Head and Shoulders. That's one dandruff shampoo that really works.
Somebody should give him the word.
Maybe he's listening. We repeat, Head and Shoulders really works. Helps control dandruff with just regular use.
Okay, I had a lot of fun with this, so we're going to watch one more.
She'd make a great receptionist, but that dandruff...
Well, hire her anyway. I'll tip her off to Head and Shoulders shampoo.
You've been here 6 weeks already.
6 wonderful weeks.
Oh, time sure flies.
I love the job and the people.
Especially a certain young man in sales.
Oh,
well, you work fast.
So does Head and Shoulders. Sure fixes dandruff. And for your hair, too. I mean, it's sensational.
Sure is. Helps control dandruff with just regular use.
So we watch these ads today, and they just seem silly, right? Because, like, it's just basic personal hygiene. And I'm certainly not wanting to reverse the progress our culture has made regarding personal hygiene. But I think it's important to look at the process and the thought behind what we're talking about, and that's shame, even though it seems silly, because sometimes these silly things end up not being so silly. So during the Great Depression, a lot of women lost weight, and it had been kind of in to be thin, like during the flapper era. But after the Depression, it kind of again became a symbol of status to carry a little bit more weight. So this is an ad from the 1940s. It says, "How do you look in your bathing suit? Okay, we're used to these today, right? But the thing is that there's a reversal here. Skinny, thousands gained 10 to 25 pounds this new easy way. All you need is ironized yeast flakes, right? So women in the 40s were looking at this and feeling ashamed because they're too skinny and thinking that they need this product. But just 10 years later, ugly fat makes you old before your time. Excess fat means loneliness and embarrassment. And that's kind of the message that has been perpetuated through the decades. This is Twiggy. She's kind of known as like the world's first supermodel, and she was really popular in the 60s, very thin. And she kind of helped set the stage for thin being so admired, even though like the ideal body has changed a little bit through 70s, 80s, 90s. Overall, there's still this pressure to be thin. And that explains why today, a very large percentage of our supermodels have eating disorders and other mental health issues. So the reason why this isn't silly is because little girls come into the world, little girls like me, and are wired with this desire to love and be loved and to be accepted, and are taking in this information from every angle about how exactly we go about that. So little girls like me play with Barbies and dream of, you know, meeting someone one day and all the other cheesy things that we think about and want to be beautiful. And sometimes that goes wrong. So briefly, I just want to share a little bit about how it went wrong for me. And that's that when I was 12, 13, I felt a lot of pressure to look to be thin, and I was already thin, but I didn't think I was. And so this is a picture of me 3 days before I went into the hospital, and you can't really tell, but like I weighed about 80 pounds, and I still felt like I was fat. So I ended up going to the hospital a couple days later, and through a very long process of tube feedings and fighting my parents and a lot of chaos and a lot of prayer, like, thankfully came out of that experience. But the reason why I share, and I'm not going to tell the whole story, is because silly shame isn't always silly. C.S. Lewis said, "I sometimes think that shame, mere, awkward, senseless shame, does as much toward preventing good acts and straightforward happiness as any of our vices can do." That's deep, right? Sometimes the things that are tripping us up and keeping us from loving other people, they're not these big moral sins. It's just like this horrible sense of insecurity. And why is it that shame is so damaging? Why is it that it can do that? So the effects of shame: a loss of confidence, right? A stifling of growth, an impulse to withdraw, and wounded relationships. So on the next slide, you see a picture of this show. Jesus did something healing for me this week, and I want to say that I'm grateful for it. I got asked to be on this 3ABN program called A Multitude of Counselors, not as the counselor, as the patient. And they want to interview me. It's like a group of counselors want to interview telling the story of recovering from an eating disorder. So I said, sure, that's fine. I can tell a story. So I was getting ready to tell it, and I got the schedule emailed to me that said the group of people that were going to be interviewing me. Well, one of the people on the list was my friend Christina. So this is Christina. She's a therapist in Tennessee. The reason why this was really unusual is that on the left, you see Christina and I as kids. And Christina and I were best friends before I got sick. And part of my getting sick was that I didn't talk to my friends anymore for a long time. And after as soon as I started recovering, I went to Academy. And so our friendship kind of like ended because of my eating disorder, but it wasn't that we'd had a fight or that either of us were upset or anything. It was just like a mix of a life transition and that we never were really able to talk about what happened. So I haven't even had it in my head for years. Well, all of a sudden, I get this email like, she's gonna be interviewing me on TV, and like, oh wait, have I ever talked to her about this? And so I called the person in charge, and she called the person in charge. And we ended up on Wednesday having a really special conversation. And I was just praying, like, Lord, this is weird. This has been so long. I don't even know what to say. And I said, God, like, help me to know what it is that I should ask her. And I felt like, well, what I need to ask her is, like, hey, I realize, Christina, I never even thought, you know, I haven't thought about this for a long time. I was wondering if you could tell me what you experienced when I was sick. And I wanted to say that I'm sorry that I distanced myself, because I don't think I ever apologized. And so she was so gracious and, like, you know, she forgave me. But she told me that, like, she thought that I didn't want to be her friend anymore. And I never knew that she thought that. So it was really cool because God used this as, like, a way to reconnect us, which is cool, and now I'm going to see her next month. The reason why I'm sharing that is because sometimes our insecurities really block us from being able to experience people the way that God wants us to, because part of why I distanced myself from Christina was because I felt fat around her because she was smaller and shorter than I was, which is so silly now, but I think, like, we do that a lot. Like, we distance ourselves from people that maybe we're intimidated by, or that for whatever reason their insecurities or our insecurities mess it up. So that's part of why I think that Jesus cares about our silly shame. So I did a survey this week, an online survey, because I wanted to figure out what are all my friends ashamed of. And these are the things they said. This was the question, silly shame. This is like something maybe you don't think you should be ashamed of, but you are. Being short on finances, having a mental health diagnosis, when someone doesn't text me back, when I can't articulate myself well, when my jeans don't fit, my size, weight, and overall appearance. I'm Republican. No, I didn't vote for Trump. I'm not as productive as I want to be. Passing gas in front of strangers. I'm in my 30s and have never dated anyone. When my significant other mentions other women. When I have no great ideas when strategizing meetings. So Brené Brown is kind of like the expert on shame, vulnerability, and she has some really good TED Talks. She talks about how the genders have a different genders have a different experience with shame. For women, shame is do it all, do it perfectly, and never let them see you sweat. Shame for women is this web of unobtainable, conflicting, competing expectations about who we're supposed to be, and it's a straitjacket. For men, shame is not a bunch of competing, conflicting expectations. Shame is one. Do not be perceived as what? Weak. How does Jesus speak into our shame? Is there anything in the Bible that we can find that will help us deal with shame? There's a beautiful passage in Hebrews. Hebrews 12:2, it says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. Okay, so Jesus was about to do something very difficult, and this text reveals why he did that. And why did he do that? Because there was a joy set before him. And according to the Bible, you are that joy. You, yes, you, with your collection of insecurities and baggage, whether you feel great about the way you look or don't, whether you feel great about the choices that you've made or don't, whether you feel super confident and accomplished or you feel like a loser, you are the joy that was set before him. I was thinking about the three angels' messages, which is something that Adventists talk about a lot, and I saw something new in it this week, the three angels' messages and shame. So in Revelation 14, there's these three angels that come giving important messages. The angels just represent messages for the world before the end of time to prepare people for the second coming of Jesus. And this is what the first angel says. And this is Revelation 14, verse 6. Then I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and springs of water. So the first angel's message is to remind the world that God is the creator, right? And I've always heard this in the context of like, the world's about to end. Like, you know, God's the one that created the world, and so you need to, you know, worship him quick. And I don't want it all to minimize the importance of our end time message, so please don't take it like that, because that's not my intention at all. But I saw something new in here, and that was that the call to recognize God as creator is also a call to recognize the value of his creation, right? Because the very act of recognizing God for who he is means that we must recognize ourselves and each other for who he designed us to be. So have you ever really looked at an orchid? Orchids are beautiful. Orchids are intricate. Like, I kill every orchid that I ever get because they're delicate. Charles Darwin studied orchids and a lot of other things. And this is a story in which the Duke of Argyll, I have no idea where that is. I didn't even know it was a thing. But I guess it's a place and they have a duke. So he visited Darwin and he was talking to him about orchids. And this is what he said. In the course of that conversation, I said to Mr. Darwin, with reference to some of his own remarkable works on the fertilization of orchids, I said it was impossible to look at these without seeing that they were the effect and the expression of mind, right? There's got to be something behind this. I shall never forget Mr. Darwin's answer. He looked at me very hard and said, "Well, that often comes over me with overwhelming force. But at other times," and he shook his head vaguely, adding, "it seems to go away." That's a sad quote. Sad because evolution isn't just a theory that we read about in our textbooks, but it actually speaks to who we are. The evolutionary theory diminishes our understanding of the inherent worth of all creation, including us. And yet we see in the Bible that we're designed, that we're loved, that there's purpose. And that's one of the most exciting parts about being a creationist and believing that God created the world, is that a proper understanding of creation can solve the identity crisis and protect us from silly shame. When we see the design and the beauty of an orchid, or the crazy pattern of peacock feathers, or the funky, quirky stripes of zebras, and we know that the same mind that designed them is what designed us. And that's what David was talking about in Psalm 139 when he said, "For you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well." So when we think about our bodies, we're so, you know, programmed to just look at what's wrong or how do I fit in or what am I wearing or all of this stuff. And we need to be able to look at our bodies and say, "I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. What my body can do is amazing." And this doesn't mean, you know, anything goes. It means we want to care for our bodies. We want to treat them in a healthy way. But what the human body can do is amazing. Our respiratory system, our every system, cardiovascular system, like everything is beautiful. The way we keep ticking, the way we keep experiencing life, the things our bodies can do, climbing mountains and bearing babies and hugging people and holding each other's hands, like there's more to a body than what we see in the media. So part of being a creationist means that we can say, "I am wonderfully made, and you are wonderfully made." This is from Desire of Ages, page 668. "The Lord is disappointed when his people place a low estimate upon themselves. He desires his chosen heritage to value themselves according to the price he has placed upon them. God wanted them, else he would not have sent his son on such an expensive errand to redeem them. Not only are we valuable because we were created by God, we're also valuable because we were redeemed by his son." And when we ask the question, "How valuable am I? What am I worth?" where our mind should go is to Jesus. not should, can. Okay, so we talked about silly shame. There's also such a thing as sinful shame, okay? Sinful shame is different, and that's because it comes from when our actions don't line up with our values, right? So what is shame? What's the difference between guilt and shame? So guilt is important. Guilt lets us know, hey, what I did wasn't okay. I just hurt someone, and I need to make it right. Shame is, I'm not okay. Something's wrong with me. So guilt is very important. It's very valuable for us because we say, I'm wonderfully made, and I wasn't designed to operate in a way that hurts other people. So I'm going to respond to my design and instead operate in a healthy way. That's very healthy. But shame is it's a problem of identity. Something is wrong with me. I'm not wonderfully made. I'm an addict, or I'm a whatever. So that's the difference between guilt and shame. The shame survey, these are the things that my friends said they felt ashamed about, that they felt like were more serious: when I spread gossip, when I fail to represent Jesus, lack of control when it comes to food, I stress eat, immoral dreams while sleeping, being disrespectful to someone I care about, hurting someone's feelings, when I see certain people that know my past, when I think that God doesn't care about me, my lack of motivation, when I don't spend time with Jesus. How does Jesus deal with our sinful shame, right? Some of the other types of shame, we can just say, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. But what about when it's something that we're doing, when it's something that we don't want to be? One of my close friends has just a beautiful story, what Jesus has done for him, and I really appreciate his vulnerability in telling it, and I'm going to share a little bit of it. He grew up as a missionary's kid, and as part of that, just had a lot of pressure to be a good kid, to be close to Jesus. And so he went through Christian schools all throughout. He was a call porter. He was super involved in ministry. And yet, in college, he just kind of had this spiritual burnout where he got tired of trying to be perfect. And he decided that he was going to try something else. So his way of rebelling was becoming a student missionary, and he decided to go to Ecuador because there was like a good beach scene there. He was like, my parents will think I'm going to be a student missionary, but really I'm just going to go like have like a prodigal year and kind of see what the world has to offer. So leading up to that, he started watching porn and doing things that he hadn't done before, and he was just in a really dark place because he felt like God was condemning him, but he didn't feel motivated to do anything different because he was tired of trying to be perfect. So on his way to Ecuador, he missed his flight in Miami, and he couldn't leave for another 24 hours. And so he was trying to figure out what to do. So he left the airport because there wasn't anywhere good to sleep. And then he realized, well, there's mosquitoes all over Miami in the summer. I don't really want to be outside. So then he got on a hotel shuttle bus and just thought, well, I'll just ride around all night. And then the hotel shuttle bus man told him, yeah, you can't ride around all night, but here, I'll dump you off at a hotel. So he went out into the hotel, into the lobby, and he told the guy that was at the desk, like, hey, I'm really sorry. Can I just sit here all night? Like, I promise I'm not going to bother anybody. And my friend told me that during that experience, he was like, this is it. Like, God is punishing me. Like, he made me miss my flight because I'm doing the wrong thing. And I'm cursed now, and everything's going to go wrong. And so he came up to he asked this guy at the desk permission to sit there. And the guy said, and I'll just read what he sent me because I'm going to mess it up. I apologetically explained to the hotel night manager that I had no money, but could I sit in the lobby until morning? In a thick accent which looked and sounded Arabic, he blessed me with a paradigm-changing gift. How old are you? I told him I was 23. I have a son your age, and I know what I would do for him. I wasn't sure what he would do for his son if he were in my exact position, so I listened closely. Be out by 6 a.m. when the day manager comes in. He passed me the key to a hotel room. When I let myself in the top floor, I realized that this could be grace. The suite overlooked Miami. I have heard of penthouse suites and seen them in movies, but never stayed in one. I was confused and a bit jarred at his kindness. The story I had been telling myself was that God was punishing me for my sins, but here was a blind corner. Grateful for blind corners. We can develop these narratives, these stories in our head where we think we know exactly how God thinks about us and feels about us in our situation, and sometimes they're just really wrong. We see this also in the story of Peter, someone that experienced a lot of shame. So Jesus was in the upper room with his disciples, and he told them, I'm going to die, and all of you are, I'm going to be betrayed, and all of you are going to deny me. Peter answered and said to him, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Jesus said to him, assuredly, I say to you that this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. But a few hours later, Jesus is arrested. Peter disappears. And the next thing we see in the story, Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, you also were with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you are saying. And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, this fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. But again, he denied with an oath, I do not know the man. And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you. Then he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. Immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So he went out and wept bitterly. So how does Jesus respond to our shame? By seeking us out. Because in Mark chapter 16, it says, here we have Jesus' followers are coming to the tomb. They're trying to figure out where he is, what's going on. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man clothed in a long white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him as he said to you. It didn't emphasize Peter because he wasn't one of the disciples, but because the angel wanted to make sure that Peter knew that he was invited too. So next we see this special restoration at the Sea of Tiberias, where Jesus and Peter have a conversation. And it goes something like this. When they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. He said to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Okay, what's going on here? Like, I always used to read this and think, why is Jesus being so harsh? Like, he messed up. Like, why are you rubbing it in, Jesus? But there's something going on behind the surface, and that's that there's different words for love. And so Jesus was asking Peter, do you agape me? Like, do you have this unconditional, passionate love that will never fail for me? And when Peter was responding, he was saying, Jesus, I phileo you. Like, I have friendship love for you, but it's not the greatest love ever. So Jesus asked, do you agape me? Peter says, I phileo you. Do you agape me? I phileo you. And then Jesus says, do you phileo me? And Peter says, I phileo you. And Jesus says, okay, I can take that. I want you to be in my work. Feed my sheep. So we see this beautiful dynamic happening where Jesus isn't trying to convince Peter to say that he loves him more than he actually does. He's trying to get Peter to admit that he's too broken to love him the way that he wishes he could, but that he's still welcome to be part of his work and part of his family. Feed my sheep, because Peter needed to know, in order to be able to feed the sheep, that he was a sheep, right? And all of us need to know that. There's a beautiful story in scripture about sheep, where the shepherd has 100 sheep, and one of them gets lost. Okay, so this is a commentary from Christ's Object Lessons on kind of like what happens internally. We all know Jesus, you know, the shepherd went to find the sheep, but what's going on internally? It says, no sooner does the sheep go astray than the shepherd is filled with grief and anxiety. He counts and recounts the flock. When he is sure that one sheep is lost, he slumbers not. He leaves the 99 within the fold and goes in search of the straying sheep. The darker and more tempestuous the night and the more perilous the way, the greater is the shepherd's anxiety and the more earnest his search. He makes every effort to find that one lost sheep. With what relief he hears in the distance its first faint cry. Following the sound, he climbs the steepest heights. He goes to the very edge of the precipice at the risk of his own life. Thus he searches while the cry, growing fainter, tells him that his sheep is ready to die. At last his effort is rewarded. The lost is found. Then he does not scold it because it has caused him so much trouble. He does not drive it with a whip. He does not even try to lead it home. In his joy, he takes the trembling creature upon his shoulders. If it is bruised and wounded, he gathers it in his arms, pressing it close to his bosom, that the warmth of his own heart may give it life. With gratitude that his search has not been in vain, he bears it back to the fold. A beautiful picture, like the primary objective of the shepherd isn't, let's get back to where we were supposed to be as soon as possible. Or like, let me tell you why what you did was stupid. He just wanted to hold it close. So I wrote a poem in college about sheep that kind of reflected what I was experiencing and what I experience a lot. Today I am feeling sheepish. My way I cannot keep. I wander right into danger. Today I feel like a sheep. Today I am feeling sheepish, stubborn, stupid, and slow, knowing the way that is better, but choosing the wrong way to go. Today I am feeling sheepish, wounded, and wanting a friend to come and find me in my dark spot and bring me back home again. Today I am feeling sheepish. My shepherd loves sheepish sheep, and he always comes to my rescue, even when I've fallen deep. So I want to close with a story. I've told other people's shame stories, sinful shame stories, but one of my own, and that was a time when I fell deep in college, and I had a lot of struggles and a lot of unanswered questions in my mind, and I acted out some because of the pain that I was experiencing and because I didn't have the right conception of how God felt about me. And I developed bulimia. And I was very ashamed because I was part of a group of people that were super spiritual, and I didn't think that they had any problems. Which I found out later that they actually did. So I was like binge eating and purging and spending all my money on food. And I was at the same time like trying to be a missionary and trying to tell people about Jesus. And I just had like a lot of like inner conflict and shame about it because I felt that God like was really upset about me because I was supposed to understand because I'd already gone to like a Bible school and stuff. So I had a friend, and this is a picture of her house. She adopted me, and I call her grandma. Her name is Rita. And God sent me Rita during that time, and she said, come to my house, Like, this is where my key is hidden. You can eat any of my food. And I would come there and we would pray together and we would talk together. But I also started just coming to her house and eating her food. Okay. So I would come when she wasn't there and I would go into her pantry and she had really good food. And like, I would eat a bunch of it. And then it ended up being really unhealthy. And then I would like leave and she wouldn't know. And so then I would like buy groceries and like replace what I had taken. And I just felt like such an idiot. And I was hoping she wouldn't find out. Well, one day she was like, is there a mouse in my pantry? And we finally talked about it. And she also kept saying, like, you don't need to buy me food. Like, what's going on? And I finally just told her, like, this is what's going on. And I'm like, I'm sorry. And she said, sweetheart, are you eating regular meals? I really want you to eat regular meals in the cafeteria, because if you don't eat regular meals, then, you know, you're going to be more likely to mess up. And she's like, what can I do? Like, let me pray for you. It's okay. You don't need to get me any more food, but I just really want you to eat regular meals. And the way that she spoke into my experience then was just like this beautiful picture of, I feel like, the way that Jesus deals with us in our sin. Because we think that he's just going to condemn us or be upset. But he wants to just make sure we're getting what we need. Because he knows that most of the times when we're acting out, it's because we have a deficit. Like, either in our understanding of him or in our connection with other people. And sometimes the way that we think he's approaching our situation is so filled with judgment when he just wants to make sure that we're getting what we really need. So the next picture is Rita. And I just thank God for the way that she showed me his character and the way that he was able to let me know that he cared about me more than he cared about what I was doing wrong. So Jesus is a savior from shame. We looked at the Hebrews verse, which was that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. Okay, we're going to look at another aspect of that verse. Hebrews 12:2. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Because we're his joy, Jesus decided to not put us to shame, but to put our shame to shame. So I don't know what you're going through. You probably have a mix, like I do, of silly shame and sinful shame. But I hope that your heart is warmed today by the knowledge that Jesus loves you exactly where you're at, and that he would rather put your shame and your condemnation to shame than he would put you to shame. Thanks.
The mission and passion of Lightbearers is publishing, training, and evangelism. To hear other messages like this, or to learn how you can partner with us, visit us online at lightbearers.org. You can also call us at 1-877-585-1111 or write to us at Lightbearers, 37457 Jasper Lowell Road, Jasper, Oregon, 97438. It is through your prayers and generosity that we are able to do what we do. Thanks for listening.